My name is Vladimir Goldstein. I am a associate professor of Slavic studies at Brown University in the United States. I was born and raised in Moscow. I left Russia in 1979. I've been in the United States for more than 40 years. And since I kind of love my, kind of old country, I dedicated my life to studying and teaching it, literature, culture, partly politics, and it's interconnected sort of ties with the world. So that's kind of what I'm interested in.
Okay, so were you one of those people who was lured west by pop music?
It's definitely was part of it. That's, if you want to have a good image, somehow we all imagine that life in Russia is like black and white, while life in the West is like all shiny colors, all shiny, interesting music, as opposed to marches and all this pompous, Soviet music, and all this kind of diversity that was attracted everyone: ability to travel, ability to say anything you want, ability to joke about anything you want, ability to mock anything you want. That was kind of a big attraction.
Well, some people are saying that the roles are becoming reversed, where actually there is a increased enforcement, particularly in politics and the media, of political correctness here in the West.
They are absolutely correct. This is actually, I can't even recall that it was that bad in the Soviet Union, because in the Soviet Union there was a very clear division. There was a kind of outside world where with official kind of line, and there you cannot do anything. But at least at home we would get together with friends, we would talk and joke. While here it becoming next to impossible to say anything, either public or private. Like with all my friends in this relatively liberal university, you cannot say a good word about Trump. For example, I remember when I would say something, I was like virtually attacked. You can't say anything which kind of challenges some kind of liberal dogma here, or maybe conservative dogma in some other state. So it's become very polarized, very kind of assertive, very either politically correct or some kind of correct. And it's getting, I always think that this is kind of Brezhnevite America. I left Brezhnevite Russia and I ended up in Brezhnevite America. And
Well,
by the
so
way,
what
even the
happened,
leader,
Vladimir? What's happened? What's changed to cause this shift?
I think one of the reason is what people say is that power corrupt and absolute power corrupt, corrupt absolutely. And United States, unfortunately for itself, became an absolute power with the collapse of Soviet Union. So Soviets began to in their part of the world, they began to dominate everything. They dominated all this kind of republics and all this Eastern Europe. They began to impose rather kind of ossified, boring doctrine of not particularly sophisticated socialism. It was a far cry from real Marxism. But so they became kind of totally kind of triumphant. And that's the same thing happened here. And we see that the West is not quite ready even sort of to be challenged. The same way like in the Soviet Union when I was growing up, alternative sources of information, radio, whatever, were jammed. We're now seeing the same thing. Alternative sources of information are jammed, deplatformed, blackened, closed. So a lot of my people, friends, complain they cannot get access to, Russian channels and so on. So it's very peculiar. I think it's basically corruption and laziness, intellectual laziness, and the idea that, well, we are doing fine. Let's not change anything, and let's not sort of be open to any new things when we are doing fine as it is.
Well, look, we're just hearing that in the Czech Republic that people are being told if you express pro-Russian sentiment, then you could do up to 3 years in prison. And this is just a comment on Facebook.
This is such an irony because I remember that when Czechs they were ready to sort of to fight for the freedom not to follow the dogma, to say anything they wanted, not to go to prison imprisoned by the Soviets who imposed some kind of a dogma, and now they themselves, having liberated themselves, now they kind of turn into the very opposite, and now they're sort of banning and everything. This is very sad, and honestly, I never thought that I would witness that, because this is so peculiar, like when the angel becomes devil and devil becomes an angel.
So anyway, you're doing Slavic studies there, teaching it. What is a Slav and what's the history of the Slavs?
Well, this is a very complicated issue because, first of all, there is, you know, this is, first of all, what unites, you know, all the Slavs is sort of language. You know, I still, you know, I can understand a fair amount of words, be it in Serbian, be it in Czech, be it in Polish, and so on. So that's kind of more or less unified. Also, sort of certain part of the territory, say, you know, of course, all the way to Eurasia and Russia, but also the Eastern Europe. But then the differences come in because, you know, we have, you know, some Slavs are Orthodox, some Slavs are actually kind of Catholic, you know, like Poland, for example, very, very powerful kind of Catholic thing, you know, country. Lithuania connected with it, Croats as opposed to Orthodox Serbs. So this religion and culture began to kind of pull people apart. Now in former Yugoslavia, we even have, you know, Bosnia, which is kind of Muslim. So I think certain things unite Slavs, but certain things really pull them apart. And as we know through the history, very frequently these people would fight against each other. You know, there's a very famous case, of course, you know, Poles would always, you know, kind of be in fight, and the fighting ends with Russia. They conquered Moscow in 1612 and imposed their own king. With Napoleon in 1812, they actually joined Napoleon to invade Russia. Then talking about Ukraine in 1920s, when there was a civil war in Russia, Poland wanted to grab Ukraine, and they did. So then Russians start to fight in the back. So we see how sort of how Slavs are, they are like, you know, you can look at, you know, French fighting Germans, maybe Western or some you know, Romans people fighting with each other. So it's not necessarily guarantees camaraderie, friendship and understanding.
No, certainly not in Eastern Europe these days, particularly with the invasion of Ukraine. Now, what do you make of the decision in February of the Russian government to do this? Or was it just Putin himself?
I don't think it was Putin himself. I think it was like long coming. You know, what I don't quite understand, why now? Why, you know, not say a year ago and not in 6 months?
But well, just sorry to interrupt you, but it happened just after the Munich Security Conference, didn't it? Where Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, for the first time called for actually bringing back nuclear weapons to Ukraine. Now, obviously, this is the sort of thing the Russians really did not want to hear.
That's absolutely not. And I think maybe there was like a particular escalation of aggressive talk ever since, you know, 2014 Maidan Revolution and then sort of, you know, loss of Crimea when Russia took over Crimea. There was like escalation of aggressive talk in Ukraine, more and more aggressive that Russians are subhuman, Russians are this, Russians are that, and sort of then the Russian language it was, you know, being banned, and you know many things occurring, and NATO, and let's get more lethal weapons. So that was you know, conversation. Eventually Zelensky said that. My feeling is I don't think it may be a pretext for the war. I think the serious causes are much deeper. It's basically in, you know, extension of NATO, all this kind of despite endless Russian complaints. Russians would complain and NATO would, you know, expand. Russians would complain and NATO would expand. And then eventually Putin began to sort of sound again and again, this is our red line. This is our red line. Take it seriously. To which he would get like, we don't recognize any red lights. This is 19th century talk. Don't talk to us like that. Ukrainian people have to decide, you know, what they want to do. So I think that kind of, you know, back and forth definitely got all the Russians nervous. And then, that probably was a straw that broke the camel's back. This is the talk about nuclear arms.
Yeah. What about the rights and wrongs of it, though? Which side are you on?
I fully understand Russians. I mean, it was like that was a big festering wound. They have their own particular kind of military doctrine. So basically, which is based on parity. If you hit us, we'll hit you. And then, you know, I'm sure that from what I read, people there calculate how much time it will take for nuclear arm, nuclear missiles to hit us, you know, in Moscow, here, there. And then they realize that, you know, the closer NATO gets, the more defenseless will be. So the whole Soviet and Russian doctrine of parity was going basically down the drain. And the Russians couldn't take it. Like, you know we don't need to support it or condemn it, but you know that every time Israel feels that something's happening, say in Iran or in any other place, when nuclear bomb can take out Israel, they attack. So I think it's basically all came down to the concept of self defense, and you know we traditionally we understand self defense. I'm not happy at all that Ukraine got in the middle, because it is an argument with rather recalcitrant NATO and United States and Russia. And, you know, the United States being, you know, senior, most powerful country in the world should have been much more relaxed and say, okay, we already have our bases in Baltic republics, in Poland, in Romania, in Bulgaria. We don't need anymore. If Russians get very nervous and uptight about it, you know, be it. But the United States is, you know, preferred to give a finger to Putin. And, you know, now, unfortunately, the war started and people are dying. But, you know, I understand why Russians did it.
Is there any point in the Russians negotiating with Zelensky when, you know, the alternative, of course, would be for them to be talking to Washington itself? Because it doesn't seem as if Zelensky really is, you know, I mean, if you look at the situation on the ground, trying to look at it from the ground up, one would have thought that he would want to give in to the Russian demands almost immediately, because none of them are really any different from the way things are today. The demands being, number one, that he's not to join NATO. Well, he's not in NATO now. That wouldn't mean any necessarily great change, just about intentions into the future. Plus the breakaway republics in Crimea, to give up the claim to them. And at the moment, actually, there is no real claim on them, and they are completely independent, even though there is a border where fighting's going on. So it wouldn't be a tremendous amount, really, for Zelensky to just say, yeah, OK, let's just do that and stop the fighting. Because and I wonder whether you think that he is really doing what the United States and NATO want, rather than being his own man working for and in the interests of Ukrainians.
He is definitely not his own man, and he is definitely cannot keep interest of Ukrainians in mind. He is not independent. Whether he just reads the script given to him by State Department, or he tries to add something, and then he gets pulled off. I don't know. You know, in other words, is he just a puppet, or does he want to do something but then said no? But we've seen the pattern every now and when, and then there is like a tech or something. He said, oh, we're willing to negotiate. That's, you know, neutrality is fine with me. And then, like 5 minutes later, there is a statement from State Department, no negotiations under bombs, no negotiations under this or that, and then he backs off. And so consequently, he's playing this Jekyll and Hyde, saying something, you know, maybe to Ukrainians and to Russians, and then he goes to London, or he goes virtually addressing a House of Commons, addressing a common, you know, Congress, and the only thing he says, we need, you know, more weapons, we need you cover the sky over us, and calls for more war. So I really don't know, but what is clear from this pattern, he doesn't have interests of common Ukrainians in mind, because he basically should sit down and negotiate. Russians do not want to subjugate Ukrainians. They know it's impossible, and they don't need it. They don't need their territory. The only thing they need is friendly neighbor about whom they're not going to worry, and with whom they can actually trade, because this is Ukraine geographically is an absolutely enviable position. It's like gateways between, you know, Russia, and of course think about China on one side and Western Europe on another. So that's how they, for example, make about 20% of their money, by sitting on this gas pipe, which transports gas from Russia to Germany and to Western Europe. And Ukraine makes a lot of money on it. So they could have made a lot of money on everything else. But for some reason, they cannot push away their dependence on the United States, whether there is a lot of money involved or something else, I don't know. But they don't act at their own agent in their own interests.
Well, look, 3 years ago, Zelensky was elected on a platform of negotiation, of peacemaking with Russia. I mean, the previous president who came in after the coup, Poroshenko, he was much more belligerent. But the people voted for a president that was going to stop the conflict in the breakaway republics and was going to start talking to the Russians about calming everything down so people can just kind of go ahead with their businesses, invest into the future. And now, of course, we've got completely the opposite. So how did Zelensky turn around?
I think, you know, we know from the politics, you know, politicians can promise a lot of things, but then either the reality or pressure, you can call it if you want the deep state or anything, puts a lot of pressure. So what's happened in case of Zelensky, and I read a lot of people right at the time when he was elected saying he has very narrow corridor to move and he wouldn't be able to move where he first promised because, you know, he gets the pressure A, from United States and B, from right-wing nationalists. List of real thuggish, violent people who you know, based in the west of Ukraine and in the places like Mariupol. And these violent people actually intimidate everyone. And they just basically any politician who began to claim to move a little bit, you know, toward Russia or something, either get harassed, bullied, beaten, killed, whatever. So they put the pressure. And, you know, United States, for some peculiar reason, kind of sides with them and want Ukraine to be hostile. So whatever he promised to common people, you know, have to wait because he has to accommodate this doctrine that no negotiations with Russians are bad. We don't want this kind of breakaway republic. We need to conquer it. We need to subjugate it. I have a feeling that either he kind of, you know, was bought into that or he is bullied into that, but that's where he is now. He is not going to lead Ukraine out of this quagmire because I suspect he's simply physically afraid of this, battalions. And this.
Well, look, one of the great big questions that the journalists, at least some of them, are asking is why are there so many accusations by the Russians and others about Nazis over in Ukraine? Obviously, the Nazis went away many years ago, and Zelensky himself is Jewish. Of course, he would not be in charge of a country, of an army that contained Nazis, would he?
Well, I mean, what we have to understand, you know, we live through the kind of complicated world. And if you think about, say, fascists and Nazis in Italy, their main thing was not necessarily anti-Semitic. They would use violence for their purposes. They would use particular kind of things for their purposes. But, you know, I wouldn't associate Nazis necessarily with, anti-Semitism. So because, you know, after all, if you look at Warsaw Ghetto, Nazis there would allow it to exist for a year and a half, and they were dealing with a Jewish leadership in this ghetto, but it was still a ghetto. So I think this is a complicated issue. What we have there, and Russians are very well aware of that, this right-wing nationalist battalions, who many of whom, what they do, and that's where accusation of Nazism come, they begin to idealize this Second World War Ukrainians, collaborators like Bandera, Shuhevich, Melnik, and other people who, in Russian, you know, understanding and in historical understanding, were working with SS, with Nazis. They were instrumental in killing the Jews in Ukraine, killing Poles in Ukraine, and introducing some kind of, you know, Ukrainian Aryan state. So these people are now, the streets are called in their names. So it used to be Lenin Street, now it will be Bandera Street. It used to be sort of some Marshal Konev who liberated Kyiv, now it'll be Melnik Street, and so on. So that's where accusations of Nazism comes. Not that they are going to bring, Auschwitz, and that they're going to bring some kind of, you know, German kind of methods of dealing with the Jews, but A, they are promoting these former collaborators, and B, they use intimidation, bullying, and virulent nationalism, like total, banning of Russian language, rewriting history. And so that's where kind of Nazism comes from.
Right. So where do you think this is heading, and how long do you think it's going to last in Ukraine?
Well, from what way, you know, my feeling is that Putin, you know, he already said, A, he crossed the Rubicon, so he basically has to say B. I don't think he'll back off. He will accomplish his goals. And so far, as we know, somebody calculated that all amount of kind of sorties, whatever you know, Russians kind of let go to bomb Ukraine, like Israel, when it bombs Gaza, does it in half a day. So in other words, it was pretty lethargic campaign. They're moving, but they are not going for the jugular. They're not so they are moving very slowly. But I mean, it depends. But I think his purpose is he'll finish this job. What kind of job he'll finish? My feeling is if there is no negotiations. If there is no negotiation, if there is negotiations and he gets what he wants, then Russian army backs off and has either leaves Zelensky or some other leader, which will be kind of, you know, good for Ukrainian and good for Russians. It's not going to be easy to find, but that's it. But if they resist, then he probably will just take kind of more or less one side of Ukraine, eastern side of Ukraine, and either. I don't think he'll become Russia, but he will give them name, some kind of maybe Novorossiya. That was a kind of one of the names which used to be there. So it will take eastern Ukraine and maybe parts, some other parts along the Dnieper River, you know, eastern parts. And the rest, you know, he will probably bomb again airports and things like that, so to degrade them military. So that's, I see, the most sort of a realistic solution if there is no negotiations. I don't think Russians are ready to go to the western Ukraine where everybody dislikes them, everybody hates them. They don't want a guerrilla warfare because, you know, for time being, they are fighting soldiers. But if they go deep in the west around Lviv, they will have a guerrilla warfare on their hands and nobody wants that. So they're definitely not going there. But, you know, that's a scenario. Either he agrees, they sit at the table of negotiations and make a deal, or, you know, he'll just have like eastern Ukraine either independent or part of Russia eventually.
And how long until he's completed the job, do you think?
Well, you know, I don't know, but I have a feeling that, you know, maybe Russians, you know, we know that Russians now turn to you know, rather became more religious. At my time, it was very anti, you know, atheistic state, anti-religious state. But, you know, I know that Easter, big holiday, is like, say, around mid-April. So I think he'll definitely, you know, would want to finish the whole thing by then. If it means escalating in certain moments, I don't know. But I don't think it will go on further than that. Maybe they will sit down and negotiate by the, you know, end of March. I don't know, but that's my kind of the most sort of pessimistic. We're talking about sort of something like 20th of April.
Well, we've seen some amazing sanctions. I mean, what do you think is going to be the effect of these? We're being told in Britain here that fuel prices are going through the roof. Of course, this is something which will affect the poor. In fact, it will drive probably millions of people into poverty in Britain who, you know, previously could afford to pay the bills. Now they can't. And some are relating this to the Russian sanctions, saying, well, if we'd have connected up that Nord Stream 2 pipeline, we wouldn't be having to, you know, add 50% to the price of gas in Britain. In other countries, it's been even higher. So what is the point of using sanctions if you're also actually, you're affecting your own population, possibly even more than the Russians?
That's a very good question. It's an important question. I think my feeling is that we don't have enough serious, you know, scientists, economists who would really understand the principles of Russian economics. They kind of were convinced, you know, either judging by some kind of, you know, statistics or something, that Russia is weak. Russia is not weak. You know, it's you know, somewhat backward in certain technologies, but, you know, it's by far the richest country in the world in terms of resources, by far the richest country in the world. They have water, they have this, they have, you know, oil, they have gold, they have very talented entrepreneurial people. And in these 30 years, these entrepreneurial people learn endless amount of skills. This is not like, you know, Soviet Union when the whole thing collapsed and Russians didn't know, or, you know, how to turn on the computer. Now they as savvy as anything. You know, I was there this November actually, and I was impressed how much more advanced the whole system of payment. You know, you just, they run around with their phones, they pay with their phones, they pay for subway. They pay for. I went to the church to see a beautiful church in Petersburg. There is, you touch the phone and you contribute money to the church through the phone. I've never seen anything like that. So they are very much advanced. So they will actually do under pressure. Russians traditionally do well, and you know they will, if they, you know, make themselves more independent from American companies. You know, hamburgers, Big Macs, they can do without them. They can do much better product. So it would primarily, in the long run, in the short run, it will hurt Russians, but in the long run, West is really sort of, you know, shooting itself in the foot and introducing total reorientation of a global, order. They blame Russia for this attack, for overthrowing global security. But I think these sanctions is actually, you know, drawing the world in a totally unprecedented direction, because for 30 years, Russia was part of the West. You know, Russian programmers will be working in Palo Alto in California. They'll be doing research in London. They would be doing a lot of things. So it was like all involved. Russians were at a certain time one of the biggest consumers of Bentleys and Rolls Royces. You name it. So they were a part. Now the whole thing is more or less cut. Russia will join forces with China and India, which is giant part of the world. And the Europe will have to pay higher prices and, you know, smaller market. And I think it's pretty silly. I mean, they could have talked about some things to, you know, punish Russia, do this or do that. But the sanctions sound like totally insane or deranged, in my view. And, you know, self-hurting mostly.
Well, they have followed here in Britain, in banning the Iranian TV about 8 years ago. It's now RT that's been banned. And so I suppose the Atlantic Council, NATO and their friends will all be thinking, well, we've won a propaganda victory here.
Yeah, that's a very small kind of consolation. That is, they ostracize the world, the parts of the world, which are actually don't want to be ostracized. We have to think, you know, think indeed globally. There are serious issues in front of the world, from climate to pandemics. People should be involved. I mean, what if there is next time pandemic something? I mean, Russia is a giant country. So how is it going to work? How are they going to, you know, if they say we don't give you the medicines, or, sooner or later, all the diseases would jump in Russia will spread all over the world. So this is just an example, or the other way around. So we need cooperation, not this kind of cutting the ties. But I think for some reason there is, I would say it's almost like a death wish or suicidal wish that the West get used to the idea of being hegemonic, in the United States in particular, and they just cannot face the fact that they have to share, that they have to sit at the table and negotiate for with the Chinese, with Indians and partly with Russians, for multi, polar world. They just cannot accept it. So they prefer to, increase the volume, increase the aggression, as if, like, you know, the more sanctions they introduce, the more hegemony they will have. But, you know, for anyone who follows the money, they see that this is actually totally counterproductive from weakening through the dollar to weakening, economy and so on.
Sounds to me what you're saying is that the propaganda victory may make the Western leadership feel better, but it isn't going to make any difference on the ground at all.
No, but what is also bad about propaganda, there is a great line of Dostoevsky in Brothers Karamazov, when one character says to another, but the most important thing is not to lie to yourself, because sooner or later you begin to believe your own lies. And I think that's exactly where the West is now. They begin to believe their own lies. They were lying to themselves that Russians are weak. And that's actually now, of course, Ukrainians continues to do that, coming up with this totally ridiculous ideas that Russians need some kind of weapons from China, while it was sending giant amount of weapons to China all this time. So they began to believe that. So the Russia is weak. I remember that Senator McCain, Russia is gas station masquerading seen as a country. You know, I remember how it looked in 1990s. It did look like a gestation masquerading as a country. Now it's absolutely modern. You know, very quick, very well organized, very kind of dynamic country. You'll be in Petersburg and Moscow. You look around, you would know: are you in Bristol? Are you in Petersburg? Are you in New York? It's just absolutely modern country. So, but the West convinces, oh, this is a tyranny, and everybody hates Putin, and they're going to collapse like a house of cards. This is very believing their own lies, their own propaganda.
Amazing, isn't it? I mean, this is what we're seeing here. On almost all the national programs seem to have, even if they're nothing to do with current affairs, have got some sort of slant on them to do with Ukraine and how terrible Russia is, how lovely and wonderful the Ukrainians are. We've seen Zelensky like a rock star speaking to the EU. They're getting down on their knees, they're clapping, they're crying, they're worshipping. The same in the British Parliament. Also, of course, in the United States this week, talking to, I think it was Congress, that Zelensky's on a live video link from, Kiev. Well, maybe it's not. Maybe he's in Poland. It's difficult to tell with the technology these days. But there is a definite whiff of Orwellian 2 minutes hate, where everyone is supposed to be shaking their fists at Putin in a very 1984 fashion, and it's a kind of Russophobia. I just wonder, this seems to be almost a serial problem, in that you mentioned earlier, didn't you, Napoleon charging over trying to take over Moscow. We had Adolf Hitler doing the same, and now it almost seems like this has come back again.
Yeah, that's very sad and very silly. And it's you know, a definite miscalculation. You know, what I remember in the end of last century, 1995, 1998, when the same thing began to happen with Serbia. They began to, increasingly demonized. They're bad. They're creating some kind of concentration camps. You know, I'm not saying the Serbs were angels, but there was a lot of fighting between Serbs and, you know, Albanians and this and that. And every country did a lot of bad things. But somehow in the West, it was just fascist Nazis again. You know, Serbs were compared all the time to this. They creating concentration camp for Muslims. Bad Serbians. Eventually, it ended up with a bombing for 78 days and arrest of Milosevic, their leader, who was a bad guy, Putin hate. So I think that's kind of the playbook which they were hoping to achieve: the same escalation of volume, the same kind of accusation, the same demonization. Putin is a kind of new Milosevic. The only problem is that Milosevic does have, you know, biggest amount of nuclear warheads in the world. He had none, but Russians do. So this playbook does really work in that case. This is one thing. And another one, as I said, this is deep Russian anxieties and insecurities about NATO. This is decision done not by him, but by all top brass people who kind of thought about it and worried about it. And I would say, had there not been Putin, had Putin resisted it and started acting up some kind of pacifier, he would have been pushed away. Somebody else who would just continue this doctrine will be brought in. So it's a very naive thing to think that, you know, we will call him a devil, Milosevic, put in trial, and then sort of Russia will collapse. I'm not sure. Maybe it could have collapsed under Yeltsin in 1990 when it was indeed very weak. But a lot of things changed since then.
I'm trying to get at what is behind this Russophobia, though, because, I mean, the only thing I can think of is, you know, the Orthodox Catholic split, and the Protestants and the Catholics all, you know, they were both more controlled versions of Christianity. And there was always this rivalry between the Catholics and the Orthodox ever since. Well, wasn't it the siege of Constantinople? And there was a battle there. But I wonder, what is at the root of it, do you think? Is it a religious thing? Is it cultural? What do you think it might be?
I think it probably has a lot of reasons. At a certain moment, it sort of turns on. But religion, you know, there was a big split, of course, around, I think, you know, 11th century. And then, of course, I think it was like in the third or fourth crusade, on the way to Jerusalem, Western knights totally sacked, totally destroyed Constantinople, and that's the wound which all Orthodoxy remember. So there's probably suspicion. Then as time developed, you know, there's a very, very big role in this process began to play Poland, who is a, you know, kind of Catholic. They began to assert that where we are, it's the edge of civilization. And the word Ukraine is actually a Polish word meaning the edge. So that's where the civilization is. You know, and Poles did a tremendous amount of work in trying to Catholicize Ukraine, and they actually have like so-called uniats. You know, half of the Ukraine is actually, they allow the priests to be dressed like Greeks, but they recognize primacy of Pope and so on. So Poland was this kind of cultural, you know, kind of divide. There's barbarians at the gate, Russia, you know, Ukraine is kind of at the edge, and there is a West kind of to the left of it. So that's another thing. But I would also say that, you know, I guess every politician will know, every kind of country at a certain moment, they need some kind of scapegoating, especially when things are not going well. So, you know, we're looking for scapegoat. And I think, you know, Russians, unfortunately, it's an ideal scapegoat. There are theoreticians, historians who think, you know, what constitutes a scapegoat. And usually this scapegoat, be it people or individual, they have to combine certain strengths and certain weaknesses. You know, say historically, Jews were scapegoats because there are not that many of them. They are kind of not that powerful. But yet, you know, some of them are bankers. They have money. They have this. So this combination of strength and weakness is ideal for scapegoat. If you look at China is unbelievably, you know, powerful country now. The economy overtaking everything. They are too strong. They don't have any weaknesses. So it's next to impossible to turn them into scapegoat. And you cannot last a scapegoat in Libya or Serbia. It's not enough. But Russia is ideal in that sense, is ideal kind of, you know, scapegoat. And I think it will be milked. We have to be, you know, step back and see that economy, neither in the United States nor sort of in Western Europe, is doing that well. There are certain kind of, they're running out of ideas, they're running out of kind of steam. A certain discrepancy grows up, reach, you know, we see this kind of spectacular inequality. So, what can be better? You know, look at England. There was a big scandal with this party gate with Johnson. Who is talking about party gates now? We have an ideal scapegoat. Bad Russia. Forget about, you know, me breaking all the laws and, you know, partying until I drop in the face of other English people. Forget about it. You know, let's all hate Russia. So I think they are kind of, the Russians, that because of their size and because of their particular weakness, let's consider like simple school. Do you think like some bully will pick up and absolutely smallest person? No. Bullies will pick up on somebody who is kind of somewhat big, but somewhat clumsy, somewhat awkward, and see, whoa, look how tough I am. And that's kind of a rush, unfortunately.
What about Syria? Because people have pointed to the similarity, really, between the Russian operation mopping up the Ukrainian army, who are embedded in many cases in urban areas, to mm-hmm. what took place in Syria. In fact, maybe the Russians have practiced and learned this technique since 2015 in Syria, which they're now starting to operate and use it in mainland Europe.
No doubt about that. The Russians, you know, they were, you know, at a certain moment, that's talking about what pushed Russia to the edge. You know, apparently, you know, first there was like around one of the sanctions, hostilities after Crimea. And then, you know, Libya was destroyed. And then the Russians said, okay, you know, we have to draw the line in the sand. And they practiced a lot in Syria. I mean, I don't want to use the word practice. There was, you know, violent, but they learned how to do that. And if they can shoot something from, you know, from Black Sea and hit in Syria, sure enough, they can hit and shoot, you know, a lot of targets in Ukraine. So Ukrainians, of course, they are now like, we have like, endless amount of equipment being pushed there, lethal weapons. But I'm not sure that, you know, they can challenge Russians there. So Russians did practice there, in Syria, and they will use it if it comes down to that. For the time being, they are fighting like with half strength. They're not using whatever they learned in Syria. They're not using it yet, because you know you hear they tiptoeing about the cities. They are like trying to shoot only places from where they've been shot. So you hear all this, you know, screaming and yelling from Western propaganda. Oh, they destroy this, and then they say, oh, actually, there is only three people dead. But you know, there's three people dead. You know, when they were leveling United States or Russia were leveling cities in Syria, we're not talking about three people. We're not talking about 300. So Russians are not doing that yet. But you know, and one hopes that it wouldn't come to that. But I'm sure they know how to do it.
There just seemed to have been a sort of shift in, you know, if you see it as the great chess game, which is as a big new Brzezinski's analogy in some cases, the grand chessboard, that the Russians have got a new confidence in Ukraine. It may be misplaced, but it certainly seems that they've seized the initiative and that they surely wouldn't have gone into Ukraine if they didn't actually have the confidence to win a wider war, should it come to that.
I agree with you there, but there is nothing wrong with it. I mean, what is bad is to have this kind of wrong-headed arrogance. But you know, they probably size it up, and you know, let's sort of keep it in mind. This is, you know, a long-lasting neighbor of Russia. They have endless amount of Russians having relatives there, so they have superb intelligence. They know very well, not Americans, not British. You know, who might have their like 500 spies, whatever. Russians, you know, probably every second person has connections, and they can find out. They know very well, you know, military capabilities of Ukraine, and they wouldn't have gone there had they known that they cannot get, you know, what they want. So they, but I don't think they're going to abuse it. You know, what we see emerging, I think, is this kind of Russian-Chinese kind of unity. How it's going to work out, Russians probably should also worry about it, because they don't want to be totally fall, you know, say, develop independence from the West and then fall totally into the lap of China. I mean, we should probably be very well aware that one country which is really benefits from that is, of course, not even the United States, not NATO, which might be cementing itself, but, you know, we talked about economics, they're shooting themselves in the foot, but China is benefiting from all sides. They're learning how to do things, what the West does, what Russia does, how you fight this, how you do this, and they, you know, now getting all extra oil and all extra resources from Russia. So Russians would probably, you know, would worry and be concerned how to be on equal footing with China, rather than thinking, oh, you know, we're so confident we can push somewhere. They don't need it, honestly. The only thing they need is, like, develop what they have already, which they have a lot, and, you know, have peaceful neighbors on their side.
I suppose what I'm saying really is that it seems like in the 21st century, the United States opening shots were the September the 11th attacks, the war on terror, and it almost seems like the tables have turned.
I think they are definitely, you know, they're definitely, you know, turning, because for a while, the United States was the arbiter of war and peace, and they can do it in Iraq, they can go to Afghanistan, they can bomb, you know, Syria, Libya, Serbia, whatever they want. But now I think it's, you know, that now, you know, this new kid on the block or new sheriff in town and says, you can do that and I can do that. And I think, you know, what it says, it doesn't mean that we have to raise this upmanship, then the United States will bomb somebody. But what we have to do is to realize that there is a, you know, multipolar world, and let every country sort of walk and compete. That's where they have to compete, in Olympics. But what they're doing, they're banning Russians from the Olympics. They're banning Russians from sport. This is totally ridiculous where we're going with it. So I think, for me, it says a lot about this ideological kind of bankruptcy of the West. So rather than kind of facing new reality, they continue to use methods which are not working anymore. You know, this is a different world. Now Russia and China are powerful countries, and U.S. cannot be sole arbiter of war and peace.
Well, that's a big change. Anyway, look, Vladimir, I wonder if you could just point listeners towards the ways they can follow you on social media, your books, that sort of thing.
I have pretty active sort of page on Facebook. A lot of people read me because I try to sort of once a day do some of my musings where I connect my knowledge of Russian history, Russian literature, and I put it sort of, you know, use that as a point of departure to discuss the present. I have, you know, a lot of articles with Russian authors. I publish political stuff. You know, you can find, you know, Google me, Vladimir Goldstein, and you can see my, you know, I published an article in Forbes about how the West got everything wrong about Ukraine. And, you know, I have articles on Al Jazeera and, you know, and many other things. My main book, of which I'm pretty proud, I wrote a long time ago on a Russian romantic poet Lermontov, Heroes of Their Time, where sort of I discuss Russian sort of, you know, complex relationship with heroism and individualism. But it does explore that tremendous amount of Russian courage and sacrifice and ability to fight to the end too. So people can find me as long as they look at Vladimir Goldstein. My last name doesn't have letter D. It's Goldstein, and they will surely find me.
Okay, finally, can you just point us towards one of these great Russian writers or poets that you think is good for our times today?
I was just surprised. I was teaching Tolstoy, Anna Karenina, and at the very end of it, they have again discussion about the war. Part of Russia wanted to fight Ottoman Empire for suppressing, Serbs and Bulgarians. Part of Russia said, no, it's none of our business. We shouldn't be there. So we discussed it with the students. You know, I was teaching Anna Karenina kind of recently. It's an amazing book. It has all issues from adultery to politics to relationship between the classes. I would definitely recommend that book. You know, of course, Tolstoy is very well known, but it's worth reading. Another one is a fantastic short book I was thinking about is Babel, Isaac Babel, Babel. And he wrote this small collection of short stories about civil war in Russia. And all this war is actually takes place in today's Ukraine. So once you start reading his short stories, you'll see the references to all the towns which we hear now. And that's where, you know, Red Army, it's called a book called Red Cavalry, was fighting Ukrainian nationalists, Poles, and there were some remnants of Germans. So this Ukraine was already a theater of very bitter war before. So Babel, Red Cavalry, might be very interesting for your readers. And each story of his are two or three pages, but they really give you the very guttural sense of the area.
Vladimir Goldstein, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, and all the best.